Welcome to Native America Calling. From Studio 49 in Albuquerque, I'm Tara Gatewood. Individuals and tribes across Native America are working right now to protect sacred places. There are many strategies that can be used, from protests to rallies to lawsuits and legislation. Are you working right now to protect a sacred place in your community? Did you have to make a tough decision on how and when to share why that place is sacred with the people outside your community? Is there a point when it's worth opening up to lawmakers? Stay with us and share your thoughts right after National Native News.
For National Native News, I'm Tristan Ottone, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. The Notah Begay III Foundation is defending its decision to withdraw support from a celebrity golf tournament last week. As KJZZ's Carrie Young reports, the foundation was one of multiple nonprofits to do so after discovering the title sponsor of the tournament was the Washington, D.C. NFL team's Original Americans Foundation.
Community leaders have criticized organizations for removing their sponsorships from the golf tournament, arguing the focus should have been on the importance of supporting education for Native youth. Clint Begay is a spokesman for the NB3 Foundation. He says foundation leaders stand by their decision.
We're all in support of funding positive things in Indian communities, but when you start associating it with the Washington Redskins, which is something that is just not very positive in Indian country throughout the United States, we just have to stand our ground and stay true to what we're trying to be as far as the NB3 Foundation.
The National Indian Gaming Association also removed their support from the golf event after learning of the Original Americans Foundation's involvement. The sponsorship withdrawals are the latest controversy surrounding the NFL team's foundation. For National Native News, I'm Carrie Young.
Two Tlingit carvings on display at the Yale Peabody Museum are stolen property and should be repatriated to their original owners. That's according to students and scholars at Yale University. The carvings of a bird and a bear were allegedly taken from a Tlingit village in 1899 by Edward Harriman, a railroad man and avid collector who took items from tribes in Alaska that later found homes and museums around the country. However, after the passage of the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, many of the items Harriman acquired and passed on were returned to Alaska. Yale students, professors, and a repatriation manager from the Smithsonian Institution say the carving should be returned to Alaska. In 2012, after prolonged pressure, Yale returned items taken from Machu Picchu in Peru by archaeologist Hiram Bingham. A petition to form a new Santa Fe Indian market has gained over 340 signatures online. Supporters of the petition say it's time for a new Indian market to be created, run by Native Americans. The petition on change.org comes in the wake of Chief Operating Officer John Torres Nez's resignation from the Southwest Association for Indian Arts, or SWAIA for short, which puts on the market. However, SWAIA says most of its board of directors are Native American and has called the petition an uninformed characterization of the organization. According to the online petition, Torres Nez would become head of the new organization, and he has posted links to the petition on his Facebook page saying, quote, "Let's do this." Two bills in the House and Senate may push the Montana Little Shell Band of Chippewa Indians from a state-recognized tribe to a federally recognized tribe. The tribe has waited over 30 years to gain federal recognition, and the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs has already approved a bill that would make that happen. If passed, it would be the first federal recognition legislation passed in over 20 years. The bills are sponsored by Montana Senators John Tester and John Walsh. Without passage, the Little Shell Band of Chippewa will likely continue having to wait through the Department of Interior's lengthy recognition process. And finally, Samuel Jesse Smith Sr., a Navajo code talker in World War II, passed away in Albuquerque this week. He was 88 years old. Smith enlisted in the U.S. Marine Corps after the bombing of Pearl Harbor with the aim of becoming a pilot, but instead became one of hundreds of Navajo code talkers. Smith returned home after the war, worked for the Navajo Nation, and had 9 children. The Navajo Nation will fly flags at half-mast today. On this day in 1977, American Indian Movement activist Leonard Peltier was convicted of 2 counts of first-degree murder for killing 2 FBI agents. He is currently serving 2 consecutive life terms at the federal prison in Leavenworth, Kansas. For National Native News, I'm Tristan Ottone.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. The Convention and Tourism Department of the Albuquerque Hispano Chamber of Commerce provides convention and event planning services for Native American organizations. Information at ahcnm.org. National Native News is made possible with support from Guest House Anchorage Inn. Wake up with the sun. On the web at guesthousealaska.com. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's Friday, April 18th, and this is Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood. There are countless sacred places across Native America, and some of them are at risk. These places may be near new housing developments, or they might be vulnerable to resource development and could be mined for substantial profit. And today we want to explore the process of protecting sacred places. We know there are individuals, tribes, and grassroots organizations out there working right now to protect sacred places. Are you part of an effort to protect one of these places? We want to hear from you, and here's what we want to know. How and when do you share information with people outside of your tribe or community about why that place is sacred? There is a risk in sharing that information. Is the risk worth it? Join our conversation today by calling 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And we have two guests with us in Studio 49 today. Lori Wiaki is the Executive Director of the Native American Voters Alliance, and she also helped lead a grassroots effort to protect 17,000 petroglyphs near Albuquerque, New Mexico. And Lori is Diné, and also from the Pueblos of Cochiti, and she is also Zuni. Welcome back to Native America Calling, Lori.
Thank you.
And we also have Teresa Pascual with us. She is the director of the Acoma Historic Preservation Office for the Pueblo of Acoma, and she comes to us from Acoma Pueblo. Welcome, Teresa.
Good morning. Thank you.
Well, ladies, thank you for joining us, especially here in studio. It's good to see some faces here with us. And Lori, let's start with you. You were part of an effort about 10 years ago to protect the petroglyphs from a road. And for people who haven't heard of these particular petroglyphs, why were you working to protect them?
So, in Albuquerque or on the west side of Albuquerque, there's five volcanoes, and they actually align from a north-south axis. And when those volcanoes erupted, it left behind this 17-mile-long escarpment. And throughout that escarpment, there's they actually have GIS data mapped all of them. But it's more in the neighborhood of like 25,000 petroglyph markings. There is numerous other archaeological findings there from, you know, grinding areas, altars, like a lot of things. And what you found was that there were tribes from throughout the Southwest that all had part of their history there in the form of either religious. It was recognized as a sacred place, I guess you could say, a religious site. And it was utilized by many different tribes for a variety of reasons. So some used it for war, some used it for communication, some used it for, you know, just different sorts of ways that different tribes knew how to utilize that area. And what it happened was it was on the west side of Albuquerque, and for a long time, of course, the city was still small, hadn't quite grown to that area. And once it started to happen, many of the tribes, the local Pueblos, basically understood that they didn't own any of that land, but it was definitely their belongings, their, it was their site. And so what happened was the tribes agreed to support the creation of the Petroglyph National Monument. in hopes that some level of federal protection could stop the vandalism and also halt and control the growth that was happening out there. So what was happening was people were using the petroglyphs as like shooting targets. They'd see, you know, there was a lot of vandalism where people were taking those petroglyph markings and putting it in their house or in their fireplace or, you know, to decorate their front lawns. It was really just sort of being dismantled piece by piece. And so so that was the tribal leader's response was, yes, let's go ahead and allow this area to be put into a federal status, which was the national through the national park system.
And so what was the result?
So there was two major freeways that were proposed to go through the area. We lost. We ended up finally losing. One was the Unser the whole thing was called the Unser Middle Road Project, but it included two. Well, it actually didn't include two freeways, but the Unser was part of the initial park creation, and then the other one was called the Paseo del Norte Road Extension. And the Paseo del Norte Road Extension was actually in an area where it was recognized as a lot more fragile because a lot of the petroglyphs were a lot older. And we had argued and fought for alternative routes to go around there because it was only like about a quarter of a mile difference for them to actually just create an alternate route to go around the area. And so we ended up losing. We fought the battle in a variety of different forums. So through a transportation arena, through the National Congress. They did a petroglyph boundary adjustment act, which basically allowed the federal bill basically took a slice of the federal status off. So if you think of it in layers, so there was top layer was the federal or federal lands, and they took that layer off. So then it resorted back to a city land. But there was also the state historic preservation overlay. So there was like basically three layers of protection. But of course, the city was in favor of the road. So you had a piece of the park, a slice of city land to build a road, and then back to a city or national park. It gets really confusing, but basically we lost.
Well, and it sounds like a lot of people, you know, had their minds or showed up at the table to speak their thoughts to get through the process. And I know a lot of folks who did show up to the table coming from tribal communities shared a lot of information to, you know, in a sense, justify why this place should be protected. And so that's the intersection we're coming to today and wanting to open up that dialogue of when Native communities, tribes have to open up and share information that may be sacred, traditional, in order to justify why a place should be protected or why, you know, they're connected to it. And I know that might make folks uncomfortable. And so, Lori, just knowing, you know, going through the process and hearing from different individuals about having to, share some of this information, what was that process like to have to justify by sharing information that way and, I guess, to the public?
Yeah, it's very, that's a very tough thing. And part of it, you know, you're thinking, or a lot of the tribal communities are thinking, you know, if we share this information, then it therefore proves and makes, you know, our case stronger, why this area should be protected. But what we found in our case was there really wasn't any basic respect in the first place, right? And so a lot of that information was, like, very precious to the communities, the tribal communities, the Native communities. It was very important information. And, you know, it's part of the process, right? So the federal government has to do their environmental impact study or whatever. And so they usually commission a report to go out and ask, you know, everybody what their stories are, what their sites are, and can you be more specific? Can you be more specific? And they're always, like, after every detail. And on one hand, you find a lot of the scientists, the archaeologists or the geologists. Those folks, you know, have probably a little bit more of an open mind to hearing this information and wanting to respect that information. But really where then that gets kind of battled out is in whether or not that information is not so much legitimate but pertinent, right, to the overall concerns of the general public. And so in our case, we found a lot of, you know, the media trivializing the information that was brought forth. You know, we tried to find ways to, you know, sort of block this, I'm blanking on the term now, but really trying to put a different level of access to this information. And on some levels, like the Park Service or different federal entities can try to allow that kind of like it's a different level of access. So like, you know, Joe Schmo can't just walk in and grab it and run around and, you know, make flyers of it. There was those sorts of efforts made, but you still, if they really want that information, of course they can get it because it's, you know, commissioned by federal dollars, that kind of thing. And I'm sure Teresa can speak a lot to this as well.
And Teresa's working on something, you know, that has happened recently. And I also want to remind our listening audience that our phone lines are open. And where do you stand? You know, where do you draw the line in sharing information about why a place is sacred with people outside your community? Is there some information that you can share and some that should never be shared? And is it worth it to share why a place is sacred in order to protect it? Give us a call. We want to hear from you. 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And we want to know what's on your mind and what you're thinking. Definitely, you know, you don't have to share the details of what it is you're not saying. But, you know, what do you do when you are trying to protect a place and the folks at the table who are making the decisions or have the power are asking questions that, you know, put you in that position? We want to hear about it. And if this is something that has happened in your community, you know, how did tribal leaders handle it? How did the folks who are working on the issues handle it? And is there a way to protect our information, our knowledge, our cultural knowledge, but still protect the places? Give us a call, 1-800-996-2848. And Teresa, you are working, like I said, on a similar issue, which has some different kind of details. Teresa, you know, you're working with the ongoing effort to protect Mount Taylor from future mining. And, you know, go ahead and share. You heard Lori's story, and I saw you shaking your head at some of the things she was sharing, and I'm thinking you're relating to the story. Tell us your perspective on, you know, this intersection of, you know, sharing information that is definitely also sacred to our communities.
Well, I think that there are commonalities in the projects that both Lori and I have worked on, and I'm sure across this country we can find many other tribal colleagues who have been working on their own issues within their own communities that can find those intersections. And for me at the Pueblo of Acoma, some of those intersections that we have had are some of the issues that Lori highlighted in her work with the petroglyphs. Some of the projects that we have are brought to light because of the amount of requests for information that come about with the use of the federal laws under the National Historic Preservation Act, often called NHPA, and the National Environmental Protection Act, often called NEPA, N-E-P-A. Those two laws are triggered depending on what the federal funding sources are for any given project. And with that comes a responsibility by the federal agency to consult with tribes regarding what their what the proposed projects are and if those proposed projects have implications to historic sites, cultural resources, sacred sites by tribes. Now, the difficulty that comes about with those two laws is that NHPA, the National Historic Preservation Act, was originally intended for the built environment. When you look into the history of that law, it was meant for many of our historic buildings, historic churches, places in the built environment on the East Coast. It was not intended when it was created to address those things that we talk about now, such as cultural landscapes. Under NEPA, which is, of course is a younger law, addresses the impacts to the environment. And that law focuses heavily on Western science to provide the data to ascertain whether or not there are implications to the environment or to sites. And oftentimes we come at a conflict when tribes are asked for that information about whether they have impacts to those resources. The tribes come to a conflict because, one, it is not often looked upon favorably to share that information. But two, how do we share that knowledge in a way that is advantageous for our use of that law? And oftentimes the way that information is shared is not does not happen in the ways that people can look at the implications to sacred sites. And so there are definite challenges. And one of those Lori talked about is whether that information is pertinent or not. And how we often use terms within our communities does not translate easily in English into the Western language. And so you have the project proponents and the archaeologists, the scientific professionals, as well as the people who are implementing the law, who are struggling on one hand to try and understand what it is the tribes are saying, but also the tribes struggling about how much is enough to share.
And just hearing you share that as well, you know, also thinking about, you know, learning about our community, learning our culture is a lifelong process. So one quick word, you know, often doesn't sum up a concept, or you do need that background to understand, you know, what it is you're trying to say. And sometimes you're not privy to share that kind of information. And so I want to hear from our listening audience too. We've heard from Lori and also Teresa. Does this sound like something similar your tribe has had to face? Or maybe you're hearing about it for the first time. And what do you think about this complicated web that is put in front of Native Americans to stand up for the places that they're connected to? How do you feel about that? How do you feel about what you're hearing today? Call us right now, 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And we're joined in studio today by Lori Wiaki from the Native American Voters Alliance, also Teresa Pasquale from the Historic Preservation Office for the Pueblo of Acoma. I want to bring another voice in. You know, we're talking about the law. I also want to bring in Matt Campbell. He is a staff attorney with the Native American Rights Fund, known to many as NARF, and he is an enrolled member with the Native Village of Gamble in Alaska. Welcome to Native America Calling, Matt.
Thank you.
All right. And Matt, you've heard, you know, from both Lori and Teresa, and we're at the point when we're talking about laws. And I guess the big question is, what do you do when these laws don't necessarily, you know, fit right in with the efforts that Native people are looking to them for, or maybe even looking for protection under them? Matt, what do you think?
Well, it's definitely a complicated web, as you discussed, and I think it's really a catch-22 for tribes. As Teresa mentioned, there's some laws out there that provide some limited protections for sacred sites, and they also provide, you know, the federal government an obligation to reach out to tribes and try and identify sites that may be eligible for those protections. But in order for the government to try and do that, they have to have the information about the sites before they can move forward. And so one issue you run into is that, you know, many tribal beliefs are opposed to providing information specific to sacred sites or their beliefs or practices to the outside communities. It would just be directly against their beliefs. And another issue you run into with disclosing information about sacred places and cultural properties is that it also brings attention to those sites so that, you know, if this information becomes public, you know, the outside public will gain an interest in it and want to come to these sites and look at them, practice them, touch the areas. And so it really is a catch-22. And one issue you find is that under the Freedom of Information Act, the federal government is obligated to disclose, you know, information that it has in its possession. So when a tribe provides information about sacred sites to the federal government may have an obligation to give that information away to anyone that asks for it. And so that's really where we have that kind of catch-22, is you have to look at what are the protections that are out there for the sites and then weigh that against, you know, if we disclose this information about those sacred sites, will it be protected, and then will that information also remain confidential? And there's a big, long process to go through to try and figure out if the information will remain confidential with the federal government, and then also, you know, what the length of protections will be for those sacred sites.
All right. Well, Matt, we are getting close to the break, and we'd like you to hang out. Got some more questions for you. And again, our phone lines are open. We want to hear from you as well. And, you know, what kind of strategies do you think are best for protecting sacred places? Is it worth our time and effort to try and protect sacred places in Native America? What do you think about that? And do you think individuals, tribes, and grassroots organizations can make a difference? Are you a part of one of those organizations and are saying yes right now? Call us and tell us why you think that. 1-800-996-2848. It's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And in studio with us today, here in Studio 49, is Lori Wiocki and also Teresa Pasquale. And we also have Matt Campbell on the line from the Native American Rights Fund, a.k.a. NARF. And if you have a question for any one of our guests, please call in. We want to hear from you. Go ahead and ask them. Phone lines are open. Call us right now. We'll be right back after this break. And again, you can also post your thoughts and comments on our social media. We're on Facebook. We're also on Twitter, 1-800-99-NATIVE. We'll be right back after this break. And phone lines are open. It's often said that when you put crabs in a bucket, you don't need to put a lid on it because crabs will pull each other down as they try to escape. Some say people act like this too sometimes. On the next Native America Calling, we're talking about the things we do to hold each other back.
Support provided by the Gathering of Nations, The 2014 powwow will feature over 30 bands and performances, the Miss Indian World pageant, and more at the Pit in Albuquerque, April 24th to the 26th. Tickets at the door and online at gatheringofnations.com. Learn about the importance of relationships and a focus on holistic and multidimensional awareness at South Central Foundation's 4th Annual NUCA System of Care Conference, June 16th through the 20th in Anchorage, Alaska. Learn how South Central Foundation deploys, aligns, and integrates its relationship-focused approach to healthcare delivery and how Alaska Native people are shaping healthcare. Register today for the NUCA System of Care Conference at scf.cc.
Yat eh. At ispa ahiyane gibin ya besoj anande ya hailabin ya shahulon ro lehlishinzen. Eit anikwe hulon igan gait oje zel in plaz anike in da zel in da kudin nol in lote. Nigay aik shes plaz ago koban da notra ro lehl tzad kwishint la adat a ya aje na khada hulon. Na ida kita hulon iya 1-800-318-2596. Aje kudidne erodaihealthcare.gov/tribal jd lehl. A message from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood from Meseta Pueblo, and we're grateful to have the support of our Native Voice One affiliates like KZYK in Santee, Nebraska, KOYA in Rosebud, South Dakota, and KDLG in Dillingham, Alaska. And here on Native America Calling, we often talk about sacred places, and throughout the year, we bring you a regular sacred places update, where we hear about threatened sacred places and the people working to protect them. Today, we want to hear what you think about strategies that are used to protect sacred places. What's the best way to share information about a sacred place that's at risk? Is it through art, a rally, maybe even an editorial in a local newspaper? Call in right now and tell us what you think. Our number is 1-800-996-2848. And I want to share a comment that came to us on Facebook. Tobias writes, It's good to point out the importance of how to protect versus specific information about sacred places. When Americans know why a place is sacred, they will vandalize it. What do you think about his comment? Call us right now, 1-800-996-2848. And with us in Studio 49 today, we have Lori Wiaki. She is the executive director of the Native American Voters Alliance, and she also helped lead a grassroots effort to protect petroglyphs here in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Also with us is Teresa Pasquale, and she is the director of the Acoma Historic Preservation Office for the Pueblo of Acoma, and she comes to us from Acoma Pueblo. And also on the line, we have Matt Campbell, and he is a staff attorney with the Native American Rights Fund. And I want to welcome everybody back. And Matt had another question for you. Do you know or can you guess at a number or a figure about how many sacred places, went out of the protection of Native communities because Native American or tribes or folks working on the issue got to a point where they didn't want to share any kind of information? Do you have any numbers on that or maybe an estimate?
You know, Tara, I don't have any numbers on that, and it's hard to say because there may be instances when the tribes themselves decided it wasn't worth disclosing that information to the federal government or whoever, and therefore those sites went out, lost certain protections. And so it's just hard to try and guess at what that number would be, also because there's just so many different sacred places, within the United States alone, it'd just be hard to guess at that.
And Matt, as an attorney, when you think about that, and you also think of the Native American Religious Freedom Act, your thoughts as a lawyer, are civil rights being violated?
Well, I think, civil rights is a broad term, but I think that's protection of sacred sites could be a lot stronger than it is. There's no real law out there that specifically identifies and protects sacred sites. We have to use this patchwork of different laws, like the ones that Teresa mentioned, and there's some others out there, like NAGPRA and FLTMA, to try and protect these sacred sites when these laws weren't really aimed at protecting sacred sites in the first place. And so... It it really is tough to try and utilize these various laws to try and protect sacred sites when they really weren't aimed at that. NARF has created a Sacred Places Project to try and look at that issue, to monitor laws that are going through Congress, and then to advocate for greater protections for and access to sacred places with Congress and with the federal agencies. And so that's one of the aspects of our project that we're looking at, is how can we, you know, come up with some laws that will provide greater protections for sacred places.
All right. And what about you? What do you think? Is it time for the laws to change? And what do you think about what our guests are sharing today of having to access, as Matt stated, a patchwork of different laws to protect places that are sacred? And I think it's also talking about protecting culture. What do you think? 1-800-996-2848. I want to hear from you. Call us right now. Let's go ahead and bring in Rob, who is in Rexburg, Idaho, tuned in on KISU. And Rob, how are you relating to this?
So I'm not Native American, but I do belong to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And as Mormons, we have sacred temples. And while there are things about those temples and some of the things that we do there that we don't discuss outside of the temple because of how sacred we view the things that we do there, we do try to be able to discuss and inform people as much as possible so that there is a greater appreciation, a greater level of tolerance. I think that the less that people know, the more misunderstanding can occur. And so, you know, whether it be on, you know, our church's website, lds.org, or other places, we try to share as much as possible about the ordinances and other sacred things that we do and what we believe, as really a way to try to garner more support. And again, I don't necessarily know the specifics about what types of things are being considered sacred here and whether or not those really could even be discussed. But just as a general rule, I think that the greater level of openness we have, the greater likelihood we are to be able to come to more meaningful agreements and
all right,
an overall
Rob.
Greater level.
All right, Rob, thank you for your comments. And what do you think? 1-800-99-NATIVE. Let's go ahead and bring in Albert, who is in Albuquerque, New Mexico, tuned in on KUNM. Albert, what do you think?
Good morning, Tara. I am Albert. I'm a Native man. I am also a professor here at UNM in Albuquerque. I teach a graduate course, among many others, in Native American economic development. And this is an issue that obviously is ongoing in Indian country, but we also talk about it with my students. And I pose to them that question, you know, and this dilemma. Progress is not the same, does not have the same meaning for Native people. And the bottom line, so to speak, is not always the main issue for Native people. As you know, and as everyone knows, a lot of our cultures and our artifacts are very sacred, and we hold them secret for that reason. So, what's to be done? We've gone, just like you all, have gone around the table and gone full circle and trying to figure out what's the best way to approach this. And I think, in my opinion, education is the best way. Once people understand why this is so important to us, they won't be asking, you know, well, tell me more. Give me more detail. Can you be more specific? It's basically an understanding. It's a tough issue. Definitely agree.
All right. Albert, great to hear from you here in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Teresa, what do you think about our comments coming in from our callers?
Well, I think Albert hit on a component that's really important, and that's education. There has to be a level of education on multiple fronts. Education of not just the agency folks, but education to the archaeologists, those folks who are in the professional capacity to interact with tribes, education to the general public about what the laws are, what they do and don't do, and education about why protection of sacred sites is important. One of the things that I talk about in my preservation work is oftentimes that many of our tribes do not have a written language. And the protection of these sites is important because when development comes through, it's equal to erasing a chapter of that history book. So when we lose sacred places, whether they're archaeological sites or artifacts on the ground, taking of shards or arrowheads or what have you off of the landscape, or even by moving them, we lose the context in which to understand that history. We lose the ability to take our children and our grandchildren to these places when places like the petroglyphs or the mountains or the rivers or the lakes are lost. And so losing that history becomes integral, not just to the living communities that have a connection to it, but it's important to all of our history as Americans. We have a responsibility to protect these places, just as if we were going to protect the White House or the National Monument or any of those historical buildings on the East Coast. We don't have to share that information. There isn't anything in the law that requires a total disclosure of sacred information that the tribes have. It just asks, is that place important to your tribe? And will this development or proposed action have impact to that place? And if the tribe says yes, that should be sufficient enough for the process to continue, for the agency or that project proponent to say, okay, we need to look at different alternatives about how our project proceeds forward.
All right. And this is Native America Calling. And if you just joined us, we're talking about strategies for protecting sacred places. And today we want to know how you balance sharing information about why a place is sacred so you can get support to protect it while not divulging too much. We got guests with us on the line. If you got a question for them, you're invited to the conversation. Go ahead and ask it. Or if you want to share how this is affecting your community, we want to hear about it too. Native America, pick up the phone and give us a call. 1-800-996-2848. And Matt, before we let you go, also wanted to give you a moment to share maybe any strategies that NARF is doing or advice you can put out there to our tribal communities on how to handle and protect sacred places around Native America.
Thank you, Tara. Yes, NARF's main strategy in our Sacred Places plan is to try and utilize our limited resources to make the biggest impact that we can. What we're trying to do is monitor the various legal issues that are impacting sacred places. We want to try and collaborate with other groups that are working to protect sacred places. We also want to monitor and participate in litigation that has an impact to sacred places. And then finally, advocate, like I mentioned before, for greater protections for and access to sacred places. And one way that I think of that comes to mind in terms of thinking creatively about protecting sacred places is, for example, the Tent Rocks in New Mexico, where the Pueblos have come together with the federal government and created a national monument that they can work with the federal government to manage, and in certain times they can close down the park and utilize it to conduct their ceremonies and go out there and do what needs to be done. And the national monument status gives it much greater protections than, you know, other laws would. So that's one good strategy. And then, you know, again, it is this catch-22 that you have, but I think being able to provide at least some limited information to the federal government with regard to sacred places that are on federal lands may be beneficial when you weigh the costs and benefits. If you can provide at least some limited information, like Teresa mentioned, to let them know that there at least is these sacred places here, without saying anything further, you at least force the federal government to look at different alternatives to the projects that are there and look at the adverse effects that will come to the sacred places.
And Matt, what about, you know, holding the standards of one tribe to another of how things have been treated? Is that worth bringing up, you know, that way things are set precedence by how one case was handled? Is any of that coming into it, or does NARF look to that?
Well, I think when you talk about different places handle the issues differently. So, for instance, a Forest Service location in Idaho may say, you know, talk with the tribe there and say, oh, no, we can't protect this sacred place because our hands are tied because of the Forest Service Act or something like that. What we want to try and do is get information out there about the best practices that the federal government has done across these various places. So, for instance, perhaps in New Mexico, the Forest Service there was able to say, oh, yeah, we can use this certain law to protect this sacred site. And we can go back to Idaho and tell that the Forest Service there, hey, in New Mexico, they did it like this. They were able to protect the site utilizing this law or this framework, and so you too can also do that. And so looking at the various best practices that are going on out there is one thing we're doing in our project to try and bring the information to light so that people can use that information on the ground with their local agencies to try and provide them with examples where sites have been protected.
All right, Matt Campbell, we do appreciate you joining us from the Native American Rights Fund. And you can also find them online. Just look up Native American Rights Fund. They are also known as NARF. Thank you for your time, Matt. And, you know, what about you? We want to hear from you today. Have you ever had to make a tough decision to protect a sacred place? Call us right now, 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And Teresa, the issue going on with the protection of Mount Taylor, there's some details that are a little different from the story Lori shared earlier. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, in 2007, my office began a conversation with several other tribal Preservation Cultural Resource Office to talk about the numerous requests for consultation that we were beginning to see regarding development on Mount Taylor. Mount Taylor is the mountain that sits about an hour west of Albuquerque, New Mexico, and is a central mountain to many different pueblos and tribes, not just here in New Mexico, but in the southwest area. And in those initial conversations, we were beginning to see the result of unimpeded development that was happening. And that development, the majority of it was coming from proposed uranium mineral exploration and proposed mining, a renewal interest in mining. Mount Taylor sits smack dab in the middle of the richest uranium ore deposit there in northwestern New Mexico. And it historically has been mined in and around Mount Taylor for uranium. There was a renewed interest in uranium mining because of the price fluctuations. And also as the United States was looking for renewable energy sources, uranium was being talked about as being a possible source for that renewable green energy. But as we know, there is nothing green about uranium mining here in the United States. So when we looked at it, we formed a work group. There were five tribes that came to the table who were willing to commit themselves to finding solutions about protecting Mount Taylor. And that was the Pueblo of Acoma, the Pueblo of Laguna, the Pueblo of Zuni, the Hopi tribe in Arizona, and the Navajo Nation. And these conversations were strategic conversations about how do we look at the proposed development and how do we respond to that development given the federal laws and the state laws. And it took time for us to educate ourselves about the process. But ultimately, at the end, we decided that to get our foot in the door in terms of consultation at the earliest moment was to have a recognition by the state. And in this case, the tribes went forward with a nomination of Mount Taylor to the state, this is in the federal, to the state register of historic cultural properties. And so this TCP designation, the traditional cultural property designation that we sought, was for over 400,000 square miles. That was the initial nomination. In 2008, the U.S. Forest Service had given a determination of eligibility, what we call a DOE, recognizing that Mount Taylor TCP as eligible to the National Register. And so in 2009, we were granted that designation. But that designation was challenged by uranium industries and private landowners and land grants, Spanish land grant communities here in New Mexico. And that put us in the state court. And so in February of this year, we finally got a decision from the New Mexico State Supreme Court recognizing that designation. The ultimate designation is roughly around 300,000 square acres, but it's the largest in the state. And that designation, that listing, affords the tribes a seat at the table at the earliest moments when those proposals are being talked about. And so it gives it sets precedents here in New Mexico, but also serves as an example, as Matt said, as the best case for others to follow.
And getting back to, you know, this dilemma, maybe you could call it that, of how much information you do share, how much you don't. There's also something special about this case as well, where there is some information, but it is also closed to the public. Can you tell me a little bit about that side of it?
A little bit about the information. The tribes, of course, that sat at the table when we were moving this effort forward were unique in that they were historically and culturally different. And so we also had to get over how much information do we share with each other sitting across the table. And we also rely on each other that there are some tribes, some pueblos that are more comfortable in sharing information than others. And so we leaned on them to provide some of that information. But as the process went forward and the New Mexico Cultural Properties Review Committee, which has the responsibility for reviewing these nominations and making the designation, we provided as much public information as we felt comfortable to share, but also provided information to the CPRC that was in-house reviewed only, in-camera review only. And that information allowed them to take a look at what the tribes share in order to make their determination, but was information that was not disclosed to the public. And that was information that had archaeological site information. And under state law, we also have an obligation to protect that site information, just the way the federal law does. You can disclose cultural information, as Matt was talking about, because some of this information does, under federal rules and regulation, is applicable under FOIA, but there is an archaeological resource protection that comes about in disclosure. And so we are obligated to meet that disclosure requirement by not sharing that information. And some of that information was withheld from public during this process.
And so what is the feedback of going through the process and seeing where you are today and decisions that were made? Any thoughts reflecting back or maybe conversations you've had with other tribes about, you know, taking this unique approach of what to share and what not to share?
Well, knowing that the final nomination, the designation and the product of that, the nomination itself is a public document. And so that can be downloaded and shared by anybody. I think the tribes weigh the risk in what it would mean if we remained silent and what we stood to lose because of the significance of Mount Taylor outweighed the risk. And so the tribes decided to share that information because, at that point in the conversation, when we're talking about proposed development and the numerous amounts that were coming in, the frequency of those requests, the risk outweighed anything. And so the tribes made that decision jointly to say, we are going to share this information. Now, one other strategy that we used to protect the cultural elders, the traditional elders that were sharing that information, was to use our own archaeologists. Our own archaeologists that have been vetted by our legal teams that sign confidentiality agreements with the tribes to work with our cultural elders, so we didn't have to put our cultural elders out in front for the public to question. When those questions came forward from the committee or from the outside public, whether it's media or other legal entities wanting to cross-question or interview those folks, it went to those professionals that could handle those questions that were more comfortable in discussing that information. And that's how we protected our cultural elders from having to engage with the outside public.
All right. And we are getting close to the end of the hour. Got about a minute left. And Lori, just want to give you a moment for any final thoughts. And, you know, Teresa also shared, you know, brought us to the point of, you know, that question, is it worth the risk? Go ahead, Lori.
I just would like to say thank you for inviting me to this discussion. But also just to really point out that it really is I guess, important when thinking about what to share. Really also the fact that in federal laws, federal government, there is some level of protection that we can push on the government. The challenge is really when it's up to the development community. So all what we're talking about, I mean, on some levels, we're just talking about notification of the development that could still happen, right? And so I think that, you know, one of the things that we tried to do is we ran a bill here in the state of New Mexico to include a cause of action clause into the American Indian Religious Freedom Act. Because right now you can only discuss protection of land through all these other laws that were named, you know, all these different jurisdictions. But we're never really able to talk about protecting sacred places, sacred landscapes on the basis of that concept itself, right? And so it was something that Suzanne Harjo, different folks from across the nation helped us to write, and it did pass the state of New Mexico, and it's there for folks to review. Thank you.
All right. I do appreciate both of you joining us, and you even called upon the ears of, you know, the head office, the President of the United States in your efforts. And so great discussion, ladies. Do appreciate you sharing with us, all of our callers who participated as well. Thank you to Lori Wiaki, Teresa Pasquale, Matt Campbell, and also our folks here at Native America Calling. Thanks to Sarah Gustavus, executive producer, Monica Brain, our senior producer, and also Laura Pacus, who produced today's show. I'm Tara Gatewood.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization located in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the McCune Charitable Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Music is provided by Brent Michael Davids. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.